Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times, and Art de Roche of The Athletic. Tournament football tends to justify the old cliche about taking every game as it comes. But already, and probably inevitably, some optimistic souls are looking beyond England's last 16 game against Germany. This is how they see things. Sweden in the quarters, Netherlands in the semi, take your chances in the final. Nonsense, of course. England may be in the weaker half of the draw, and Germany may be beatable. But it's never that simple, is it, Johnny?
Well, it never is, and one shouldn't ever get too far ahead of yourselves. We've seen it before, you know, Manchester City in the Champions League a couple of years ago springs to mind, when apparently all they had to do was turn up and beat Lyon and they would, you know, the easiest draw, and they'd get all the way to the final, and of course fell at the first hurdle. England was supposed to have a procession to the World Cup final last time out, and Croatia turned out to be better than expected. I mean, at the same time, this is a golden opportunity for England as well. They are lucky with this draw, and they shouldn't have any excuses or to shy away from that. So it's about getting the mental balance right. The fact of the matter is they've got a flawed German team and then a benign draw ahead of them, and they've got games at Wembley and a final at Wembley. There'll never be a better opportunity. So as I wrote in the paper last week, this is not a time to be talking about development or making any excuses. This is a time to really go for it. But simultaneously, you cannot play a game thinking about what comes next. You've got to just think about the opponents that lie ahead. And those next opponents are Germany. There's no need to think about anything other than that. There's no need to think about Euro 96. There's no need to think about anything but a game plan to beat a team that should be beatable. And England need to back themselves, and they need to do it.
Yeah, there's going to be an awful lot of baggage lugged towards Wembley on Tuesday night. All the old stories are going to be trotted out. Are 1966, as Johnny just said there, 1996, 2010, and the goal that never was. Now, Art, it's probably not a state secret that you belong to a slightly different generation to Johnny and myself. As a member of that new generation, does history really matter?
I think in a sense it does, but it gets to a point where it's not really needed in the discussion anymore, I'd say. If we look back just like a week ago, heading into the England-Scotland game, both broadcast companies were running specials about it almost a week in advance. And I think that's a bit over the top. And then when we're thinking, okay, we're, I guess, 6 days away from England-Germany now, I'm not sure there's a desire to see England's past failures against Germany in the build-up this early. I think in terms of reference points, so past games, there's obviously going to be people who look back at those moments. And I think almost now it's viewed at not as seriously as when they happened. They're almost points just to laugh at when you think back at them. I think probably, of course, the one that I remember most is the Frank Lampard goal against Germany in 2010. But almost that now is looked at in a comedic way because it's history and it's going to have no bearing on what's going to happen on Tuesday evening. So I think, of course, you have to understand the history of the game, but there comes a point where that history is a bit overblown at times.
Yeah, well, when we're talking about Gareth Southgate, I would say don't mention the penalty, but that's already happened at about 10 past 8 this morning. With Gareth Southgate, Johnny, obviously you see him up close on a regular basis. He promises there's more to come. Tournament football exerts its own pressure. Is he fighting a bit of a crisis of faith in the way that he selects his team and the nature of his team? Is he becoming more conservative?
Well, I'm not sure if it's conservative. Well, maybe it is. There's something funny I personally feel that's gone on with Gareth and England in this whole tournament cycle. And it started with that 33-man squad, which I found bizarre, which came out of the blue. It was presented as a measured decision, and it wasn't. It was a last-minute decision to name 33 instead of 26. Then you had the four right-backs, which again felt bizarre, felt a very uncharacteristic thing to do. And I think we've seen that taken into the tournament. You know, Trippier, who played really well, but, you know, on the wrong side for the first game, then changing both full-backs, and then another set of changes for the Czech game. And I didn't even mention the friendlies where he ends up playing players that aren't actually part of the tournament. There's been a lot of strange things. And as a kind of seasoned England watcher, I suppose, it has given me memories of seeing England managers in the past sort of lose their marbles a little bit. Fabio Capello in 2010. I'm not saying Gareth lost his marbles at all, but he has done a few things in the last month that have been a contrast to the sure-footed manager who seemed to really know his own mind in 2018. Now, there are signs that there were signs against the Czechs that a plan was starting to come together. To make excuses or to mitigate things for Gareth, England had injuries coming into this tournament with Henderson and Maguire. He had a very difficult situation with the Champions League final players not being available. So if he goes on and wins this tournament, we'll look back and we'll say, well, this was all a bit of a strange build-up, but it was necessary because of all the conditions that happened. But I do that, like you just mentioned, this kind of slight lack of this loss of faith. I think the loss of faith or the test of faith in Gareth has come about because of all these changes and the sense of a team that in the middle of a tournament is still trying to find itself. Conservatism, I think Gareth's always been a little bit of a conservative manager. You know, he went to the World Cup with 3-5-2, which, you know, really wasn't an attacking, you know, Germany 3-3-3-5-2 or 3-4-3. It was quite a conservative 3-5-2. So I think that's what he is, and I think there's nothing wrong with that if that's his brand of management. On top of that, he does play, you know, he tends to have a solid block of 6 or 7 and then try and let the attackers have a go. So I don't think he's changed in that respect. I think what has changed is this uncertainty that's come into the equation with selection and strategy decisions. And I'm just waiting to see which way this goes. As I said, I've been here before with England managers. I'm just waiting to see which way this one goes. Is he gonna by the end of this show us that this is all part of the master plan, or are we gonna be looking back and saying what happened to Gareth in 2021?
Mm. Can I just be specific and actually as a personal reference point, Bukayo Saka. Obviously you see a lot of him with Arsenal. Man of the match, I think, in 3 of his 5 England starts. His directness and decision-making under pressure were really quite marked in the Czech game. Would you play him? And if so, why?
First of all, I think that's the main thing that stands out when you watch him for the first time is intelligence in those areas. That's something that was clear when I first saw him in the Czech Trade Trophy in 2018. And I think, as he's progressed through to first team debut, first team regular, England debut, I think you've seen that at each stage, as well as just his fearless nature. And I do think that not playing him in the first two group games was a wise decision because of the amount of football he played last season for Arsenal. He was the club's second most used outfield player at just 19 years old. So a rest was needed. Going into Germany, I think I would play him and Jack Grealish. I think they both gave England what they were lacking in the first two group games, in players that not only could they drive at a defence, but they could also pick the right ball. And I feel that one of the reasons Gareth may be branded as that conservative manager at the minute is because he has a variety of players in that profile who can make a difference in the final third, but he hasn't put as much trust in them as, say, his regulars just yet. And I think now that the time has come to play Germany, putting trust in them when they have proven that they can make a difference, I think it's only right. And I think that that's where England are most dangerous as well, when they have players who can make opposition defenders make decisions. And hopefully that'll be the case come Tuesday.
Mm. There's so many external considerations and complications, aren't there, Johnny? You know, most notably the COVID quarantining of Mason Mount and Ben Chilwell. Just to concentrate on Mount, who, you know, is probably more integral to England's style, given all those restrictions, well, I think they end the night before the game. Should he play? And if he does, how will that influence the balance of the team, do you think?
I don't think he can play given how close to cut off the ending of the restrictions are. I just don't think that'll be healthy for team morale. Guy that's not fully training to then suddenly be parachuted in, and it probably wouldn't be healthy for Mount. And let's be honest as well, and I love him as a player, he hadn't quite caught fire in the first two games. And, you know, I think Saka has presented a really difficult dilemma almost for Gareth, because he wouldn't have had him down as his right-sided attacking element going into this tournament, but he was so good, especially in the first half an hour against the Czechs, that it asks the question as to whether he has to stay there, especially when you think Germany have got Huijsens on the left, who's a real sort of flying machine going forward, but might leave spaces inside him to attack that Saka, with that intelligence Art talks about, could exploit. Where England have been good in this tournament, driving from midfield or just in front of midfield. Sterling's done it a couple of times, dropped deep and driven with the ball. Phillips did it a couple of times in the first game. Saka did it to sort of create the position for the goal against the Czechs. Grealish did it very well. That's been an area that England have got strength in, and they should be looking to do that against the German team that are going to play, you know, a midfield two, which isn't necessarily a very defensive midfield two if it's Gundogan and Kroos, with a defence that's vulnerable to pace, with very attacking wing backs, with a high line as well. So there's scope there. It's an interesting one. I think that the strongest part of the team has been on the left. It's been Sterling, Grealish, and him interchanged beautifully. So again, there's probably no need for Mount to come back in there. And I think the decisions are more what he does on the right, whether it's keeping Saka. I mean, you know, we may talk about Jadon Sancho. I don't think Gareth's even going to think about him. But the Germans will be amazed if he doesn't come in or doesn't come in the equation on the right. So, but I think anyway, I think the left's kind of sorted after the last game, and it's that right hand side that's the part of the pitch he's going to think about.
Mm. I suppose the bigger picture is that, you know, England need to introduce some dynamism into their performances. If you think about it, I think it's 5 shots on target in 3 games, only 1 completed cross into the 18-yard box by Reece James. And if we're going to go real nerd alert territory, there's a great Opta stat that I saw where England have got the ball up the pitch at 0.98 metres per second in open play during the tournament, which is the lowest of all the teams. And actually against the Czechs, it was even worse, 0.7 metres per second. Is that measured or is it stilted? And can a modern team essentially chug its way to a title?
I think they can. We saw with Portugal in 2016 that you can go on to win the Euros without even winning a group game. But in terms of those stats in England, what kind of springs to mind when they are read, especially the ball progression, is the profile of midfielder that you have in that midfield too. I know a lot of people would rather be safe than sorry and have two people who can make up for maybe the defensive weaknesses of the front three or front four, if you want to go with that. But when they're moving the ball forward so slowly, I think there comes a point where, especially when the Germany midfield will be, as you mentioned earlier, Mike, much older and maybe not as fit is the wrong word, but you would be able to get at them. I feel that possibly changing that dynamic in midfield could work to your favour when you need the pace of the game to be much quicker than it has been in the first three games of the tournament. And that's where, I guess, Calvin Phillips has shown that he can break forward off the ball as well as on it. But maybe next to him, Declan Rice hasn't been progressing the ball as quickly or as well as most would have expected from an England midfield. And that's where, I guess, you've got to decide whether you stick or twist with a midfield double pivot, or you move to just one person at the base and then having two more adventurous midfielders. So maybe Phillips and Foden could be used as a more central midfielder. I think those are probably the more pressing dilemmas than even Saka, because that almost dictates how the game is going to be played, what pace the game is going to be played at. So that's where I see the big decision coming for Gareth Southgate.
Tournaments never exist in isolation, do they, Johnny? You know, I'm thinking here, you know, what are the internal dynamics of the England squad when you've got three players at least wrapped up in their own individual career decisions? So you've got your, you know, to your point about Jadon Sancho, all the talk around is, you know, bid after bid after bid, penny after penny after penny. You know, £350,000 a week over 5 years has been mentioned. You've got Harry Kane. Well, we know, you know, that saga is, you know, seemingly endless. And Raheem Sterling's been brought into that equation as well. That's got to have some form of impact, hasn't it?
I think you've got to separate the players, actually. I think Harry Kane's just one of those guys who almost nothing will have an impact on him. He's just got that kind of very literal goal scorers, strikers mentality. I don't think it's going to affect him. I actually think we've seen Raheem Sterling's odd position, shall we call it, at Manchester City, affect him positively. He's played like he's got a point to prove. I think he's reminded us, actually, in the last three games, just what a good player he is, and how he's actually a bit more than he had come to be used at the City last year. Sancho is the one where we don't know what's happening behind the scenes, and I can only think that Gareth thinks it's a problem. There's no other explanation for him not being utilised and part of England's weaponry, because he's such a good player. And I can only think that Gareth is seeing someone he doesn't reckon is fully in the right place or fully focused. And I would have sympathy for Sancho in that he is young. This is the big moment in his career, if he's coming back to English football. And you've got this ludicrous Manchester United situation where, you know, it almost feels like they're sort of, you know, raking through the cupboards trying to find any sort of unused piggy banks or whatever that they can empty and get a few more coppers and offer to Dortmund an inch closer to the total that they need to get. I mean, you know, my goodness. So, yeah, I think it'll affect different players in different ways. And Sancho, I'm guessing, but I don't know, I'm guessing is the one that Gareth feels is affected by it.
Yeah. Looking further back in the team, defensively, you know, we can expect Harry Maguire to continue with John Stones, who's, I think, that's a decent partnership. Fullbacks probably need to be freed up a little. What about in goal? Has Jordan Pickford answered the critics? Because, you know, I'll put my hand up. We wouldn't have been my first choice had Nick Pope been there, for instance. Has he done well enough to actually get people off his back?
I think for the time being, yes. Obviously, at club level, there's still questions being asked every week. But for England, he has done very well so far this tournament. I don't think there's been any panic situations that I can remember off the top of my head. Aside from just normal goalkeeping, he has been a good presence at the back, especially, of course, they're going to harp on about three clean sheets in the group. But I do think that he has been a sound performer in goal with what happens in front of him as well. I think it's important to for him to be even more vocal than he already is with the changes that could happen ahead of the next game. I think Harry Maguire did very well coming back into the side against the Czech Republic, not just defensively, but again, in terms of getting the ball forward. He was, can't remember who the pass was to, but it was a lovely pass down the channel, which led to a shot on goal. And I think that's what was one of the things that was missing in the first two games. Although John Stones can play out the back, I think Maguire does carry it a bit further forward and can be a bit more penetrative with his passing. And then with the fullbacks again, probably they do need to be freed up a bit more. I think Reece James is probably the more adventurous right back in the squad at the minute. But I guess it does come down to what Gareth Southgate wants from his fullbacks at the time against Germany as well, considering they're going to be attacking the wide areas a bit more. They may not be freed up as much in that game anyway, because you have Kimmich and Gerson's to take care of. So maybe it's not going to be in that game where they're going to be freed up, but you'd expect it to happen at some point.
Mm. Yeah, lest we forget, Johnny, Germany was within six minutes of going out. You know, as Art said, they are strong on that left with Huijsen's in particular. You know, this is the tournament, actually, which some of the less fashionable clubs in Serie A have produced players, you know, both for the Italian national team and, in this case, Atalanta and Germany. What do you make of Germany, and where will their principal threat come from, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they're a mixed bag, aren't they? They're a hodgepodge. And, you know, I talked about how there'd been a strange build-up for England. I mean, what a strange build-up for Germany with, you know, just the stream of results, Switzerland, North Macedonia, 3 years of downturn, Joachim Löw being vilified, going from being national hero vilified, and then suddenly bringing back Müller and Hummels, which is, you know, kind of cultural equivalent, I suppose, of, I don't know, bringing back Rio Ferdinand and Paul Scholes for a tournament or something like that. But actually, the right decision, because certainly with Müller's case, he's such a good player. Hummels is you know, the pace really has gone, but I suppose he's quite an intelligent defender still. I mean, the difficulty for Germany comes from, I think, rather than name an individual player, I think I'd characterise it as nous or intelligence. I look at that team and I see Toni Kroos, who, you know, one of the passing geniuses of our generation, and Gundogan, who's an incredibly intelligent footballer, Joshua Kimmich, who, if he played in the Premier League, everyone here would understand exactly how good that guy is. Can play anywhere, just a superb football brain and competitive mentality. And then Kai Havertz, who towards the end of the season at Chelsea began showing us the talent that he is, and another very, very, very intelligent footballer whose movement into those areas is incredible. So I think that's a difficulty. I think you've got a very intelligent, canny football team who might be able to exploit weaknesses or see where the weaknesses are for England. I think the weakness in Germany is probably physically, in terms of lack of pace at the back, and just that, you know, an imbalance that's even greater than England's towards midfield and attacking talent at the expense of lack of defensive solidity.
Mm. And what they all have also got, I suppose, is, you know, a coach at the end of his career with Germany, Joachim Löw, been there, seen it, got the T-shirt, smelt the T-shirt. He's got a fantastic ability, it's always seemed to me, to actually react in game. And probably has obviously has the tournament experience that someone like Gareth Southgate does not have. What sort of role will he play? Can a coach decide a game?
I think so, yes. We saw that with the Hungary game. I think that's probably the most recent example they're knocked back twice and they come back, although it's absolute necessity that they at least get a point from that game, they got it. And I think when you're looking at Joachim Löw's CV, I guess you call it, he's been very meticulous from the day that he walked in, even when he was assistant manager, I think. And that's where game management from Gareth Southgate is going to have to come into it a lot more than it has done in any other game, I think, where, yes, you can rely on set pieces and, yes, you can have a certain way you want to go about things, but that can change in an instant depending on what happens in the game. And I think staying stuck on your plan A for too long isn't great. You have to admit when you're wrong, and you have to see that in the heat of the moment as well. And if Southgate does get something wrong in the early stages of the game, he probably wouldn't change it straight away, I don't think, but changing it at least at some point in the game, hopefully early in the second half, changing it at least at some point in the game will be important, because I think Germany will be ready to change whenever they see that England are on top in that game. I know they've played with a three at the back with wing-backs mostly during the tournament, but they also have Leroy Sané and Timo Werner, who offer different challenges up top. And if they do come on, how are England going to deal with that pace with Harry Maguire, who's going to be on his second game if he does start? And depending on what fullbacks Gareth Southgate goes for, how are those challenges going to be dealt with? That's what I'm also interested to see, because they're not easy challenges to face.
Yeah, let's move on, if we could, to Wales, Johnny. In essence, we've got the Leicester derby in Amsterdam on Saturday. Kasper Schmeichel against Danny Ward. Several issues flow from that. Just like you to dwell on Schmeichel, if you could, please. He's an emotional leader at club level, and that seems to be replicated for Denmark. You also know his dad, Peter, very well. What's the significance of the bloodline, especially in the context of, if you think about it, that win over Russia on Monday, for me anyway, brought back memories of those irresistible teams they had in the 80s. I know it's a very long and convoluted question, but how...
Yeah.
Thank you, mate. How important is Schmeichel going to be? And give me an idea of the personality of a guy who could well shape that game.
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, Mike, actually, because I see echoes of the past in that Danish team. And I thought they played like the 86 team at times in that second half against Russia, which for, you know, people before Arts, of Arts generation, rather, was just one of, you know, just an incredible attacking...
Great team.
You know,
great
what team. A team. You know, Laudrup, Elkjær, and just lots of adventure and pace and abandon. And they fell short at the 86 World Cup, but they really entertained. And that's what Denmark were like in the second half against Russia. But then you got 92 Denmark, who of course was this incredible story when won the Euros. And there's something special about the team spirit of this current Danish side that is like the 92 team. Because that 92 team was a band of brothers. A lot of them came from Bromby, including Peter, who was at Man United at the time, but was developed in the Bromby system. Very close, very tight-knit, called in at the last moment. There was a tragedy to deal with, or a real, you know, an emotional sort of sadness at the heart of that triumph, because Kim Vilfort's daughter, Lena, was terminally ill during the tournament. He actually had to leave and go and visit her and come back. And there was a soul to that team, and there's a soul to this Danish team now, which we've seen the measure of what they are as human beings with the way they rallied round and have reacted to and tried to honour Christian Eriksen in their performances. So I do see lots of echoes of that Danish past. And then, of course, when you look at Kasper, and yes, I do know Peter, and there's a, of course, it's like I said, there's a similarity between a father and son. Of course there is, but they are. It, just as Peter was more than a goalkeeper, you know, he captained Manchester United to the 99 European Cup final. he scored 11 goals as a goalkeeper. He was more than just a guy, you know, he redefined the position. Kasper is also somebody that you know, his influence spreads way outside the 18-yard box. You know, at Leicester, he's one of the pillars of the club. He's one of those that represents the identity of the club, and he him and Simon Kjær are that for the Danish team. And then of course you've got this, the excellence of his performances and his growth as a footballer. And you mentioned Danny Ward. I mean, one thing that interests me about this game with the Leicester hat on is if this goes to a penalty shootout, you know, I don't know if anyone's seen Danny Ward in a penalty shootout, but he is good. He is very, very good in a penalty shootout situation. But Kasper, in the 2018 World Cup, saved 3 penalties in a game against Croatia and went out. I think it's the only goalkeeper in history to save 3 penalties and go out in a match, 2 in the shootout, 1 in normal time. So I'd almost fast forward to a shootout and just see which one came out top, because it'd be a fascinating contest.
I don't know what you're like on Walt Disney movies, Art, but it seems to me that Wales are going to be cast as the team which essentially kills Bambi's mum. The emotional vote will be for Denmark because of the obvious backstory. You've also got, you know, Wales, a team almost, they're very similar to Denmark in as much as that they're quite emotionally driven, very close. Give me your appreciation, please, of the job that's been done by Rob Page, but also maybe look at Gareth Bale as well. How does he fit in?
When you look at the time frame that's been handed to Rob Page, I think, first of all, knowing the players enough to set a coherent plan, I'll say, is the first thing you look at, and he has done that. Even though the game against Italy almost was, I'd say, a one-off, it was very strange watching that game where the clock goes down and they lose 1-0 and they're extremely happy. That was probably the strangest that it gets. But I think aside from that, the Welsh DNA of what a performance is, so Aaron Ramsey breaking into the box very late, Gareth Bale having that license to cause havoc where he feels he can, that's been there. But also with that has come an understanding for game situations, which has seen them through the group and got them into the knockout stages. I think that going into the round of 16, rather than it being about tactics, I think it is going to be driven mostly by emotion. We all know what happened in 2016 with Wales, how far they got and how big a part of emotion played into that, how they were able to shock teams like Belgium, for instance, how they almost got over the line against England. I think that they will be met by a force in Denmark, especially not just the Russia game, which was amazing, but I think the way that they started the game against Belgium in the group stages was outstanding. Belgium just seemed shell-shocked, and I don't think it would do Wales any good to not be wary of that. Having an emotional response would be just as important as understanding what they need to do in a tactical sense, especially considering that Denmark are the opponents. So yeah, I think they have done well so far, but this is probably going to be the toughest physical and mental challenger of the tournament so far.
Emotion does obviously play a fundamental part in football, Johnny. As such, let's dwell a little bit on Scotland. Reality reasserted, and do you think there will be any legacy from this tournament for Scottish football?
Look, we have to make a positive legacy out of this and not sit there crying about yet another anticlimax. This is a return to the top table. It ended in disappointment, but I think it has given all Scots a taste for this again, and the next target has to be the World Cup. And we've got a player for the future in Billy Gilmore. You know, if you're stripping away everything else in this tournament, a top class guy that we can build around for 10, 15 years emerged. But there's a backlash against Steve Clarke. I understand it, because I think he got the tournament wrong. In the cold light of day, Scotland had the wrong team out against the Czechs and also the wrong approach to the game mentally. I think they were inhibited. conservative, maybe overwhelmed by the occasion. And it's a manager's responsibility to prepare the team right and make sure that, you know, those mentality issues aren't there. So I think this is a strange tournament to come out of, because I think Steve Clarke's been great for Scotland, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that there should be any doubt about his position. But at the same time, you're looking at a manager to, you know, acknowledge what went wrong and to try and grow from this. And I hope Steve can. And my overwhelming feeling, just as a Scot, is I've been here before, of course, every tournament, in fact, in my lifetime. But, you know, it's that Delamitri song, Don't Come Home Too Soon. Again, we were always at home, but we finished it too soon, you know. And you look at other countries, peer countries, the Czechs, the Welsh, Austria, they're still in the tournament. And why not us? We've got to do better. Scotland have got to do better as a football country. You know, yeah, we don't have the best squad in the world, but we don't have the worst. And at some point, we've got to break the cycle and play above ourselves, be inspired and approach things more positively, and just do something, for goodness sake. Just do something in my lifetime, please, please. So we can't fall back. You know, Michael Grant in The Times has written a very good piece today, as he always does, about Scotland can't just play the old, oh, well, we were proud to be there, you know, we show pride nonsense. We're better than that. We're more than that. You know, everyone's proud about their nationality. Everyone's proud of the national team. That's, you don't get a medal for that. You know, well done, Scotland. You sang Flower of Scotland. Great. Come on, there's got to be more on the pitch, and there's got to be more ambition. And let's look at that first game against the Czechs and really say, we've got to be more than that. We've got to grab these situations, got to get that World Cup, and we've got to go to that World Cup. And you know, with a player like Gilmour, actually look to make an impact and not just look to be part of it.
Yeah. Just for reference, Delamitri, probably known as soft rock combo. With Scotland, Billy Gilmour, as Johnny said, was the standout. He needs a full Premier League season on loan. Norwich are leading the scramble to get him. I just want to concentrate on one other Scottish player, if I could, John McGinn. He does look to me, and I know he has been mentioned in dispatches, a really good fit for Liverpool.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of not only does he offer goals, but he can drive from midfield. He can fight in midfield as well. I know this is probably weird to bring up, but Yaya Toure actually did a piece for The Athletic this week on the importance of bums in football. And John McGinn was one of the players that he highlighted.
We've all met a few bums along the way, haven't we, John?
Can I just interject? I saw that and it made me think Fergie once called Kenny Dalglish the best bum player in football history. So there's a good fit with Liverpool, isn't there, signing a top Scottish bum player? Carry on.
Yeah, like it was a good read, but I was laughing through most of it just because the amount of times the word bum was written, it was just amazing. But with John McGinn, he was saying how very strong core, but also very good understanding of how to use his body basically in those midfield areas. And we've seen with how Jurgen Klopp sets up that midfield, although he has very good players who can be more adventurous, like Gianni Wijnaldum, who is very much more adventurous for the Netherlands than he was for Liverpool. It is about knowing that role to a T and being able to receive the ball, push forward, and almost do that in a formulaic way. And I can see that John McGinn is a player that could do that, but also maybe just break the mold a little bit and be a bit more of himself. I think in that Jurgen Klopp midfield, you've probably got players who are limited, is not what I want to say, but just a bit restricted to what they can do in order to make that team tick. I think John McGinn can fit those restrictions because of his skill set. And also the fact that he has a very Liverpool-esque way about the way that he plays in terms of his attitude on the pitch. He doesn't he rarely ever leaves anything on the pitch. And I think he's very fearless in the way that he approaches games. He doesn't really care who the opponent is. We saw in Aston Villa's debut season in the Premier League when I think very early on they went to Tottenham, and he's the one that breaks through the pitch and scores. I can't remember if they actually won the game, but it's moments like that, the moment against Arsenal last season, where within minutes he's firing the ball into the top bin. It was given offside, but I think those are moments where Liverpool could see a player and think, yeah, we're going to take a chance in him. So that seems like a very a logical way to look at, say, John McGinn's career path and where it could go.
Yeah, let's look at some of the contenders, if we could, Johnny. Belgium, Romelu Lukaku, who actually, come to think of it, might also be called a posterior player. I don't know. He does, he does protect the ball well. Is he at his peak, do you think?
I did a column with David Moyes, actually, in the paper today exactly about this, you know, and he was marvelling at Lukaku's continued development as a footballer, where you've got a guy who, you know, was always a, he was a super talent. He was 16 years old, he was playing in the Belgian top flight, and there was a scramble to get him, and Chelsea got him. And sometimes with those players who are so physically and technically and mentally advanced for their years, the development stops. I think we saw it in Ross Bartley, for example. Because it's been so easy for them as kids, they don't feel the need to keep adding to their game, and then others pass them by. Lukaku is the opposite. You know, he's a guy that's continued to work on his game. I remember interviewing him a long time, he was just at Everton, and he talked about how he used to go home and watch, relentlessly watch DVDs and videos of great strikers to try and see what he could do and add to his game. And he's just been doing that for 10 years now. And I think what you see on the pitch is a guy who has got the full toolbox, more or less, understands exactly where he needs to be. You mentioned protecting the ball, Mike, absolutely right. You know, there's very few better at doing so. He's quite economical in his movement. You know, he's not roaming, he's not Harry Kane-ing it and roaming all over the place. He's staying in the area he needs to be, small movements around the box, timed perfectly to get in the right areas to score. On top of all that, you've got leadership, the sort of which he's shown in for Inter Milan this year. And of course, it helps when you've got Kevin De Bruyne giving you the ball. It does. But, you know, Lukaku scored something like 65 international goals. You know, that doesn't come about by accident. And I just watch him and I think, Manchester United, what were you doing? What were you doing? You had, you know, they need to sign a number nine again, and they had one of that quality. And maybe if they'd stuck with Lukaku and had built around him and been able to help him develop the way that clearly Antonio Conte was able to help him in Italy, then they might have the striker they need now. It cheers me watching him because I know that that's a guy that deserves everything he gets because he's put so much work into it.
Their game against Portugal promises to be one of the highlights of the last 16. When we look at Portugal, obviously can't go too much further than Ronaldo, who's, you know, still a force of nature, isn't he? Record-breaking or equaling force of nature at the moment. I just want to look, though, at Renato Sanchez. He was excellent against Germany. Won most duels, most ball recoveries. I think it was a 93% passing accuracy. Now, here's a player who was almost laughed out of Swansea. That does show you how haphazard a career path can be, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think when we look back to that Swansea season, if you're looking at the entire squad, I don't think any would have came out glowingly. But because he is Renato Sanchez, who did so well at Euros 2016, the spotlight is going to go onto him. And I think people will just latch onto that and think that it was all because of him. There's that famous clip from Swansea's game against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge where he passes into the advertising boards that people still share to this day. But I think that when you look at how the decisions somebody makes can almost shape a career, the decision to go to Lille is probably his best decision of all, because not only is he playing football again, but he's playing in a way where his talents are being uplifted instead of in a team where you're fighting for survival, where you have to be very probably negative in the way that you play. He's allowed to be much more positive, which is where you see those bursting runs through midfield, those little layoffs around the corner, and also that more combative nature where you are able to fight, but in a positive way. And I think this season or last season with Lille was the perfect recipe going into this summer, because now he's at a stage where, yet again, as he did in the last Euros, he can showcase his real talent. And then whether he decides to stay at Lille or not, he's got Europe at his oyster, I think, because he is still so young. We forget how young he is because he broke into the Portugal national team as a teenager, but he's still very young and has options, I guess, for his future and how he feels that he can develop. But I do think that people should maybe not forget about that Swansea season, but just take into account the type of player he is and the type of football he has been asked to play, and how that may have not been the best fit for him at the time and wasn't a true reflection of the player or person that he is.
Yeah, I just need actually, obviously, to correct myself. That performance that I mentioned and detailed was actually against France, of course. And France, Johnny, are the bookmakers' favourites for the tournament. You know, you talked about Manchester United and the use or abuse of the talent that they have available to them. Begs the question about Paul Pogba. Some of his passing in this tournament has been sensational. How can they contemplate not giving him what he wants?
Wow, I mean, that pass he played to Mbappe last night was just, you know, I made me shout out loud watching the TV. And that, you know, he played a couple of beautiful balls to Benzema as well. There's been this Pogba for France, Pogba for Manchester United disparity since he joined at Old Trafford. Of course, when you've got N'Golo Kante next year, it helps. It helped Danny Drinkwater, let's say. But it's not just that. I think to give Pogba credit, it goes beyond having Kante there. It's clearly a state of mind thing as well, and a comfort thing, where he feels able to express himself the way he does for France. Watching Pogba, there is one thing in my head always when I see him in the Premier League, and I think it's different from international football. I think if there's a weakness in this game, it's when he's pressured, under pressure. Despite having incredibly good feet and an ability to manipulate the ball, maybe it's a slight size thing or whatever, but I think in a fast game when he's been closed down quickly, he ends up having to play back and sideways a lot. And international football, it's a fact, it's not as quick, and maybe the pressing isn't quite as intense. So that's the only kind of technical explanation I can find. I think all the other explanations are to do with the players around him and the way he feels or is made to feel when he's in the different shirts. But for United, I don't know. It's a difficult one, because if they're just going to get the Paul Pogba of the last 3 or 4 years at Old Trafford, I'm not sure if it is worth renewing it. But that's not his fault. That's them. You know, I think they've shown they haven't known what to do with them. And if they can't think of how to get the best out of them, then, you know, that is on them. But is it worth 400 grand a week for the product that they got out of him for the last 2 years? It's not. But if they can get the Paul Pogba from France, if they want to have one last bash at that, then that guy is an absolute superstar. As I said, I just don't know if there's a way of kidnapping N'Golo Kante and sticking him in there instead of Fred. That might help.
There's a thought. Right, the Netherlands are. There is a new generation emerging there. You know, you only have to look at Ryan Gravenbach, who looks to be the next off the Ajax production line. Just want to dwell, if you could, please, on Danielle Malen. Now, he was let go for a nominal fee, which I think was 250,000, in 2017 by Arsenal. He's done exceptionally well for PSV. He'll probably get considerably more than 250 grand if they sell him. Arsenal have really got a bad record about letting talent go, haven't they?
Yeah, I think about this almost every day.
You should get out more, mate.
Donny Marlon, Ishmael Benacer, Yunus Musa. On the flip side, they have done well to secure Bukayo Saka, Flo Balogun this season as well. But it is something that I do just sit and wonder about at times, what could have been. But I think for the Dutch national team, Marlon's done very well, even though he didn't start the tournament as their first choice forward alongside Memphis Depay. I think their relationship is very good on the pitch, where Marlon, his freedom allows him, the pair, to bounce off each other very well. I think we saw that for Depay's goal against North Macedonia, where Marlon picks up the ball in halfway, just roams about with the ball, finds Depay, overlaps, and then plays the ball back into him. And I think that's where you want a team where a striker is more than just goals. I think we actually see that with Romelu Lukaku, where although his goals are the main selling point, he is very much a team player that can provide for his teammates. And I think Marlon can do that. Before the tournament, he was actually playing in more of a wide position for the Dutch national team, even though he is a more natural striker. But even at PSV, he has shown the ability to look for his teammates in those positions and just play the simple ball, which can be a hard thing for strikers to do at times. But I do think that going into the knockout stages, having a team that can work like clockwork and just move the defenders around is something that is invaluable, not just having a striker that stays between the widths, the width of the posts. I think giving teams those other decisions to make will be beneficial. And he's a player that I've been waiting to see given a chance at the Euros, and I'm very happy that he's done as well as he has so far, and hopefully he continues to get a chance. Because yes, at Arsenal, the only first team football he got was in a few pre-season friendlies in Australia and Asia, where he played as a right wing back. And that's something as well that is going to stay with me forever for the wrong reasons, that I'll probably be thinking about in 50 years time, thinking, why did we do that? But yeah, good. I'm happy for him, because if he didn't move to PSV, maybe he wouldn't be here right now. So can't complain, could only appreciate it.
Yeah. Just finally, you know, the group stages are behind us. Highest scoring Euros ever. Italy have emerged. Spain eventually emerged. The real tournament starts now in the last 16. But for a domestic audience, there's only one game in town, England against Germany. You know, I'm braced for the deluge. What about ourselves? What are our thoughts, just finally and briefly? Johnny, who's going to win and why? Johnny.
Oh, it's so hard to know what to expect from either this England team or Germany. I think we're going to see an absolute epic match with plenty of twists and turns and emotion in it. This is Lowe's last chance for Germany. This is Germany's last stand, England's big chance. And it's going to come down to probably moments and going to come down to mentality. If I have to nail my colours to the mast, England are a better team. And Gareth has shown an ability to rewrite England's poor tournament history. You know, Colombia, penalty shootout, got over that hurdle. Croatia this time, winning the first game. I've expressed doubts about or questions about how the backdrop of this tournament has been played by him. But I do think that having Maguire back on the pitch is a huge comfort. I do think there were signs of it coming together against the Czechs. And I suspect England are going to prevail on a sort of night of real, you know, as I say, twists and turns. And if it goes to penalties, I'm not sure if they'd win. So I'm not, but I think it might be an extra time winner or something, I don't know, from, let's say, from Jordan Henderson scoring his first ever international goal. Some kind of mad storyline.
Yeah, love it. Oh, what about you?
I think it's going to go one of two ways. Either it's going to be very much like a chess match, I think, for 90 minutes, where Gareth Southgate maybe hopes to just stay in the game for as long as possible and then nick it. If he does go that way, I think England will just about get through on, like Johnny said, in extra time, probably 2-1, I'd say, because I don't see them keeping another clean sheet against Germany, how Germany attack down the wings. The other way I see it going is him keeping faith in Jack Grealish and maybe Bukayo Saka's not the one to go for, but a player like Bukayo Saka that can drive forward. And if he does go that way, I do feel a bit more confident in it being done in 90 minutes. But I do still feel that it'll be a very close game that finishes 2-1 again, but just in 90 minutes rather than 120. So to keep it short, I'd say a narrow England win.
Yeah, that sort of conforms to my thinking as well. I think England are probably the better of two flawed teams. But beware, there's going to be a lot of specious nonsense floating around before Tuesday night's game. With tongue firmly in cheek, here's my contribution to the pile of pap. We discussed the emergence of Robin Huisens. He was born in a town called Emmerich. Lothar Emmerich won the last of his five caps for West Germany in the 1966 World Cup final. They equalised from his last-minute free kick. But, and I suspect you know what's coming, West Ham went on to win the World Cup in the shape of Jess Hurst. History has spoken. Or has it? Thanks to Johnny and Art for their insight, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast. Enjoy the game, if not the build-up.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.